In episode 10 of The Composter, I sit down with Carrie Oceans, educator, consultant, longtime industry leader, and someone who has helped shape what composting looks like as a profession in the United States. For decades, compost has often been seen as something you just figure out in the pile. But as this industry grows, as we handle more material, more policy complexity, more public scrutiny, it's becoming clear that composting isn't just a job, it's a profession, one I'm so proud to be part of. Carrie has spent over 30 years working in composting education, research, and industry development, from county government to Cornell University to the U.S. Composting Council. Through the USCC, he helped develop the week-long intensive composter operations training course, which we get to talk about quite a bit. Carrie personally educated over 1,000 operators through that course. In this conversation, we talk about what it really means to become a composting professional. Carrie has so much experience in this realm. I meant to stick to that topic, but we do stray towards the end of our chat about the concerning legislation in California that is impacting the bioplastic industry. We only touch the surface of this, and we are going to need a whole episode about California and the new compostable labeling law. One fun fact I learned in this episode is that by listening to this podcast, you can earn continuing education credits through the USCC Compost Operations Training Course. Carrie will explain. Before we dive in, I want to say thank you to this episode's sponsors, AgriLab Technologies, Compost Capital Network, and Compost Systems of Austria, for supporting the show and the work of composters everywhere. If you care about building people as well as piles, this episode is for you. Take a breath, get comfy, and listen to Carrie Oceans. Welcome to The Composter, a podcast for compost lovers. Gravity rings around Saturn and Mike. I'm your host and fellow composter, Jane Murner. Through real conversations with composters and industry professionals, we are digging deep into the science, technology, and art of compost production. Whether you're managing a large-scale site or just compost curious, this podcast is here to inform, inspire, and connect us all as part of a growing movement to enliven the world's soils. This summer, I visited Vermont Natural Ag Products, the home of Mudu Compost. One thing that really stood out was an innovative system from AgriLab Technologies that both speeds the compost process using aeration and captures thermal heat from the compost to warm the Mudu bagging barn. Ingenious. I reached out to Brian at AgriLab Technologies afterwards, and I'm thrilled to share that they now generously sponsor this podcast. AgriLab Technologies provides solutions for efficient composting. Their team works with farmers, commercial, institutional, and municipal composters to save energy, labor, and space on your site. Their modular compost aeration equipment and technical support services improves process control, making better compost faster, with less odor and impact. They can also capture renewable thermal energy from composting to heat nearby buildings, wash water, and for drying finished compost. Build your soil and burn less oil. Reach out to AgriLab Technologies today. Visit us at agrilabtech.com/podcast. In 2023, I went with my son on a compost tour of Austria through the International Solid Waste Association. Maybe not your typical family vacation, but ideal for the two of us. I was impressed with the 30 years Austria has thoughtfully developed a whole nation compost system, which started with the 1992 ban on food scraps being landfilled. A steady voice in Austria's composting world is Aurel Lubke of Compost Systems of Austria. Like me, Aurel carries his father's legacy, restoring soil fertility through quality compost. With an engineer's mindset and a farmer's heart, he turned that passion into Compost Systems of Austria, now a proud sponsor of this podcast. Compost Systems of Austria is your engineering partner for state-of-the-art composting facilities, from small open sites to large enclosed plants and everything in between. With full odor control, they handle everything: process and facility design, odor and emission management, plastic removal, moisture control, logistics, optimization, and the most reliable compost turners on the market. Contact Compost Systems directly at compost-systems.com or through their North American partner, Green Mountain Technologies, at compostingtechnology.com. Compost Capital Network brings together composters, haulers, and capital providers. It supports the next generation of composting infrastructure through educational events focused on financing and by facilitating connections. CCN is proudly sponsored by Laurel Mountain, Claire Vest, and Compost Now. CCN is an initiative of Wanu Organics, a consulting firm focused exclusively on composting and organics recycling. To join the network and learn more, please visit compostcapital.com. Harry Oceans, welcome to The Composter. Thanks for being on.
Happy to be here.
Carrie, I'm excited to talk to you because you've been in the industry for so long and so many different hats you've worn in composting education, research, industry development. I'm excited to dive in today and talk about professional development in our industry. Can you take us back to the beginning, though, and how did composting find you?
I love to talk about that because it's been so much of my life since it happened. So I actually got interested in composting way back in the 70s. I went to Cornell University as an undergraduate studying agriculture, living with folks. The back to the land movement was kind of happening, and did our home, started a garden and made my first batch of compost. I was so excited, made a big pile, and then went on to spring and opened up this pile and nothing had changed. And I was so disappointing and said, there's something more to this that I'm missing. And so got more involved. And I remember the first time I actually made a pile that got hot. I was just so amazed that this would happen. And that wonder has actually helped sustain me through the rest of my career. But I went from there. I didn't do anything professionally at that point. I was a baker and a chef and a caterer. And then I went to graduate school, became a high school science teacher. I taught science for several years and then I needed to go to graduate school. So I started going around. And this is now when late 80s, the solid waste crisis was among us. And people were running around saying, they're going to close all the landfills. What's going to happen? And I started going to conferences. And I went to one conference, and Professor Paul Connett, who has notably one of the starters of the anti-incineration movement, held up a bag of earth grow compost from your home state of Rhode Island and said, these people are taking leaves out of landfills and making compost and selling it. And I thought, that is a beautiful thing. I want to make more of that happen. And so ended up going to graduate school, really to study how to get change, how to increase adoption of these kind of really great practices, specifically composting. Spent the last 30 years or more trying to do that, trying to take those lessons and say, who are the stakeholders? How can I have an influence? Where does that happen? And that led me to Rodale Institute. I was their composting guy for several years. We had the disaster of testing some of the earliest not compostable cutlery that was reputed to be compostable. And I'm sure there's a farm manager at Rodale that still curses me when they find plastic forks in the field. To a county, you know, worked for a county for a bunch of years. I got to run the loaders and actually make compost and also help them expand into early food waste collection from grocery stores. We were working with local farmers to do that, and did a deep dive into the for-profit world. I got really excited about Feltrex and kind of using compost for erosion control. And I thought that's an amazing process. It helps the water, it helps the developer, helps everyone, helps sell compost. So I did that for a couple of years before this opportunity to work for the U.S. Composting Council came along. And I was one of the first professional hires under Stu Buckner, who did save the council at one point. He was really instrumental. He hired me and we became part of the core staff at the U.S. Composting Council, and did that through the rest of my career, the last 16 years, also working for Research Education Foundation, kind of on loan from the council to CREF to develop their education programs. And so I ended up doing a lot in professional development in many different forms.
I love that you said that sense of wonder about that hot compost pile has driven you, sustained you through all these years of keeping that sense of wonder and bringing that to the people that you're educating.
Mm-hmm.
That is sometimes lacking in our educators. And I think people drawn to compost really need that sense of wonder because we're not typically traditional academic types, where traditionally we want to get our hands literally dirty out there. And so having that sense of wonder as an educator is, I think, just key to really connecting with people in this industry.
Absolutely. I remember Carl Hammer. You did interview Carl.
Yeah,
you talked about the epiphany of compost. And, you know, when I was not growing up Christian, I didn't even know what that meant, but I had to figure out what does that mean? And I really loved that imagery as well. That was way back before I lived in Vermont.
So let's see, I want to like skip around a little bit too about what are the most common knowledge gaps that you saw in operators with your 1,000 operators that went through that training program? Was there something consistently that operators were unprepared for or that you were surprised weren't aware of?
You know, when we launched that program and we saw we're getting 30 to 35 to 40 people coming for a week, leaving their jobs, leaving their homes, it's a big investment. Mm-hmm. And people come from all walks, from all over. And so just when I was in Pennsylvania, we did composting for dairy farmers, you know, and so there was a real commonality about who showed among dairy farmers. But the people who come to a week-long training on composting are pretty diverse. And so, no, short answer is no, there's no common, because we try in this week to cover the big picture of running a facility from the time stuff comes into the gate to when it goes out to market and with some context around the book. And so depending on people are coming as second career people who have been in tech industry and are tired of that and are coming and they have all kinds of math knowledge and systems operations. You know, or we have, you know, farmers or we have landscapers or we have landfill operators, consultants. You know, it's a really diverse group that shows up. But that, of course, is part of the joy of the class is that you get these exchanges. You get so many aha moments from different people around the room over the course of the week because depending on where they're coming from and how much knowledge much context they have when people learn new things in professional development is we're talking about learning and how people learn and why they learn, what's the motivation for learning. And so part of what goes on in learning is you have to have a kind of a framework to attach facts and knowledge onto. And so depending on what they're coming from, what their previous context is, that's where they're going to start building from how they'll learn. So I wouldn't say there is a common...
Not like a consistent thing that you saw.
No,
yeah,
no,
yeah, it's really neat,
you know,
actually.
Math. Some people haven't sat in a classroom in 30 years and just being in a classroom is a challenge.
Totally.
And staying still. And people, their day jobs would interfere, right? They have to make a sale or make a decision or the people would often people come into class that have some responsibilities that they're
can't leave for so long.
Can't completely put away. So the hurricane, the tornado's coming and they have to, you know, a third of the class leaves because they're, they have to get home. They're all work for public works departments. And
yikes. Yeah. My first year managing this farm, you know, I grew up here my whole life. I felt like a real lack of skill in running a business. And so I took the 10,000 small business classes. It was like a 3-month thing. We just one day a week, I had to go into a classroom and I couldn't even have imagined finding the time for that with the amount of stuff I had on my plate. And I found it super valuable. And I remember going into the class and there was people from all walks of life, all sorts of different business owners. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I'm going to have nothing in common with this group of people. What is it like running a restaurant and this person's running a clothes store and this person's running a medical office? Man, there was so much in common between us just running a business.
Sure.
I learned so much from everybody in that class. It was really, really awesome. And so I love when you're saying people are entering this operator training program from all walks of life and different perspectives. It adds so much to the room.
Yeah, they get a sense of kind of what's the bigger picture. As an educator, my job is, you know, to help them kind of understand what their obstacles are and how they're going to overcome them.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever those are.
Yeah.
And give them tools to do that. They're not going to learn everything in a week. They're going to learn a framework and they'll hopefully remember some key facts that will be important. And they'll also learn how to, when they do have a problem, where to go for answers, either back in their own notes or in the contacts they've made and the networks they've built through and beyond those courses.
Yeah, that's the best part. And learning that it's important to take time to step back from your business and look at it from a bigger lens, that hawk lens, I call it, from like way up high.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It really has been helpful for me. And sometimes I forget to do it when I get stuck in the nitty gritty day to day stuff. And then I have to step back. I have to keep doing that. It's been a huge part of my professional development is taking that time to step away. Great. Okay. So if I was someone new getting into this industry, and you could give me the ideal pathway entering this compost industry today, what would that look like for you, for somebody new starting out?
Yeah. You know, it, kind of building on the last, you know, in terms of who's coming to class is such a broad walk of life. And I think one of the things I love about this industry, and I've been so privileged to have this vantage point, is to recognize the really diverse roles there are. So it really depends. You had Justin, listen to Justin Garrity. You know, he was an entrepreneur. He was coming into the industry because he wants to build his own business and start bootstrap it up. that person would have obviously very different advice from someone who is really interested in people and sales and wants to know, how do I get involved and use my skills that I have, my interest. That was, you know, I'm a biologist, I'm a nerd, and I want to really delve into what are the microbes, why do we hit this pH plateau, what microbes are driving this process, and how can I modify it? So I think there's some, depending on whatever interests you have, there are roles and pathways for you to learn how to apply those in our industry.
Thinking about our listeners, mostly I would say, if I'm wanting to get in and start a compost operation,
okay,
what would be your ideal path for that? Yeah.
So I definitely would start by networking. I mean, really, one of the things that I love about this industry, and you've heard this before, is people are so generous with their time and their knowledge, because they're not really threats to each other. We're only in a few cases that composters could be with each other. And so I would go to conferences to meet people. I would definitely shadow someone. If you're spending some real time with someone who's doing what you think you want to do, and help them out, volunteer, whatever, you know, but shadow someone to really get a sense of what you're getting into. I definitely have seen some people come take my course who were not prepared for the amount of work it was going to be, and had some really rosy pictures. So I think I would start by really understanding the industry and the business. And if you're going to be in an urban situation or a suburban, rural, where you're thinking about this, ultimately, this is obviously a very site-based place. And one of the challenges is that every site is different. There's zero cookie cutters. There's attempts. There's some pretty close things. I think of McGill kind of has a standard thing that they build, and they've replicated that 6 times, 8 times. I don't know how many facilities they have, but ultimately, you know, every site has to adapt to its suite of feedstocks and regulations and land use laws and climate and soils. And there are so many variables that's why you have to understand. When we teach people, we have to teach them, understand the process, understand the dynamics, and then apply them to your specific situation.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I'm in the process of help reviewing chapters, management practices. So unlike BMPs, best management practices. I've fought for the term GMPs for our industry, because there's no one right way to do things in our industry.
Yeah.
And we have to acknowledge that and say, okay, these are not best management practices, but these are good management practices. And that we all should follow. And so writing those, and so thinking about the diverse situations that we're in, and how can these apply universally, or how do we make them apply or be adaptable to whatever situation you're in?
Yeah, so many different climates and environments and slopes of land and different things. Yeah.
Yeah, I grew up in the Northeast, New York. You know, I'm Pennsylvania. I did a lot of my training, so I was very familiar with compost in the humid Northeast into Midwest. And moving to California when I did early on in my work for the council, and moving to the arid Southwest was such an eye-opener. It was like, this is, because their kind of baseline vegetation is different, right?
Yeah.
It has to be more lignaceous, it has to be more resistant. Since most compost, no matter what you take in, is at least half woody material of some kind or other.
Yeah.
Not everyone, but was an eye-opener to see how different compost can be based on where it is. And that's one of the things that we do in our course. There are operations training courses, operator training courses that are 2 days, 3 days. And I get one-day courses. We've done those, and they're really valuable. But we really push and insist on this five-day course, because it gives us time to include a day on the product.
Okay.
At least one day on the product. And one of the things we do is we collect compost from all over the country, and we lay it out. Here's 12 different composts. These are all certified good composts. They're so different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the texture's different. They smell different. They look different. And so that's being able to do that in that class and have it tactile, you know, that you smell it, that they look at the end. And then we have the analysis. But that's kind of that part of that big picture understanding that they then go away with. They're saying, here's where I'm going to fit in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So getting back to your question about how does someone get into this business from a business side, I think it's networking, shadowing, take a few courses, of course, and we can talk about where are professional development opportunities, where can you go to learn, but then ultimately, obviously, you have to take the plunge.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's really great to shadow, because like you were saying, you might even realize, this isn't what I thought. I'm going to switch directions. I think that's important for every industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you don't get millions of dollars in and realize it's not what you want to do.
Yeah, we've had some great failures in our industry, so we'll try to at least learn from those.
Yeah. What else do you want to talk about with professional development? What are opportunities out there? Yeah, just spin with it.
So first of all, I want to say this podcast is a great opportunity. So if you're certified, you need to get continuing education credits. I think if you're out there and you're certified, you can get credit for listening to a podcast.
Wow.
It's just the same process that you'd use for getting credit to a webinar. Go on the website, find the right form, say, I did this, here's what I learned. Take a screenshot of your podcast player showing that you listened to the whole thing and you could get credit for it.
No way. That's so cool.
Well, it is true. When we think about, we were building this program and we said, okay, what is the path for continuing education? How do people get credits? And one thing they do is come to the conferences, but we still have to document that. And so we said, okay, if someone goes to a session and they have a piece of paper that says, I was in the session, someone signed at the end. At the end of the conference, they submit the records that shows, here's the sessions they attended, and they get credits for that. So we kind of said it's not a high stakes. We're not super documenting their attendance. They could have technically shown up at the end of the session, and you would have signed that paper. And okay, but there's a certain amount of trust in here. You know, we're saying,
yeah,
you know, that, and you sign every paper that says, yes, this is true. I did this. Right. So there's some trust there.
Yeah,
trust, like some accountability. And you say, okay, that's our bar. That's what we do to get most of credit. So what else? So if you go to a webinar, same thing. You go to an online conference, especially we started, you know, 2016, I think we launched. That sounds about right. And so then, of course, during COVID, there was no conference. So we did a lot of online training and the same thing. But you fill out a form, you say you went, and you can get credit for it. And so now there's a lot of education opportunities, professional development. And again, it's not just professional development is just that. It's how do you grow as a professional? And part of what we did, part of the message is, yeah, this is a profession. This is real work with real knowledge and real expertise. And we want to recognize that. And if you can document that, we want to celebrate that if you take the time to do that. And ultimately, you know, why does someone get certified? It may be because they get a bonus at their work that they do that. Or they may be just, a lot of it is really the self-satisfaction of saying, you have knowledge, you have expertise. We want to be able to put that on your letterhead, put that in a signature.
Yeah.
That and because it's true and you've documented it and you maintain it. So how do people get educated now? So there's, like I said, so going to conferences, going to webinars, lots of webinars out there. And as I said, podcasts are no different than webinars in terms of the process and what they would do. And there's courses. Of course, our five-day course is still out there. And CREF has continued to expand, well, try to expand it. So we're doing 5 or 6 courses a year. I'm saying we, it's they.
Mm.
Compost Research Education Foundation runs those courses. So there's those. And there's, I said, Washington has one, Maine has one. There's a few other 5-day courses. The 131 School of Organics is an online school.
That's James McSweeney?
Sweeney.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
That's great. Resource. And he does different types of formats. Learning online is really different than learning in person.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's those. He has a variety of courses. He has a certificate. You do earn a certificate. And there's just a quick point difference between a certificate. This means you did one thing. So you get a certificate of attendance, a certificate of completion, different than certification, which has this ongoing continuing education component to it. So just a difference between those two things. But he has certificate programs and he's doing some online things with, if you're really into microbes, he's got a microbe course now that Lin Fang is teaching. And then Institute for Local Stuff Alliance, if you're on the community composting side, listen to that.
They have so great, much good stuff on there.
Great, yeah. Set of courses that are available online. They did a whole 8 lesson suite on community composting. I attended all of them. I watched all of them. They're really good courses.
Even beyond community composting, it's applicable. They have a new rodent guide. Lots of research through there too.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always worked with them and respected their work and supported them. State chapters. USCC is up to 17 different states with chapters. And so, and part of what those chapters do is education in different ways, whether it's in person or online. Yeah. And then there's all the other state and regional organizations, like you mentioned, NERC, the Northeast Recycling Council. Mm-hmm. They did a webinar. We have a really important program that the council and CREF have started called Compost U.
Mm.
And that's an online resource. for taking courses. It's still developing. It's got hundreds of courses. Those courses basically are mostly lectures from our annual conference.
Okay.
So we capture those lectures, they're recorded, and so you can replay them, and USCC packages them up as an annual conference. So you could watch all the recordings from this year's annual conference if you didn't go to the conference. That must be 40 hours.
Yeah.
And all in 20 to 30 minute segments. So okay. You get a credit. One CEU is 1 hour's worth of education or training. So a half hour course would earn you 0.5 credits for watching. And we really want to see that grow. Would love to see more. Our vision for that is we have all these great resources, education, but they're all kind of mid-level. They're not beginning level talks.
Yeah. Right?
That you don't get very few beginning level talks at a conference. That's not what it's there for. So we kind of need more on the beginning level side, but we have lots of intermediate and advanced stuff. And that's our vision, is to have a place that anyone can go. You don't have to be a member, although you do get a member discount for the courses. And if you want to learn about safety, we have a lot of safety courses in there. We have equipment specific courses, all just everything. There's 14 different categories of courses.
Wow.
You know, whether it's in water protection, odor, safety, equipment, operations, marketing, and obviously I'm missing half of them.
Are the workshops, those are pre-workshops, like the foundations of composting that Bob does? And I took Jorge's compost math workshop, which was fascinating. Are those recorded and on there as well?
No.
Okay. Those are long ones.
Well, there is one foundations course. So there is, yes, there is. We did do 1 year of recording a foundations course. So they don't change that much from year to year. So that's available as a 6 hour course altogether.
Okay.
In 6 1-hour segments. We haven't done any of the pre-conference workshops, and those are longer format. They don't really make for.
Yeah.
You can't watch online. People just don't learn that way, right?
Watching true.
To break it up into smaller segments to make it work.
What about tours? Because I learned so much from compost tours and farm tours.
And one thing that council is doing is, I mean, you're right. I mean, I've been so fortunate because of one of the things that we required when we designed the course is like, we have 2 heavy days of lecture and then we take a break and we do a tour and we go out and see how these things actually play out in real world. And we try really hard to get, a diversity of feedstocks, operations types, sizes, et cetera. And usually it's 3 courses. Our record was 8 stops in 1 day that we did out of Cornell because they just like all these little micro stops. But yeah, tours are really important. And the same thing, like if you come to the council at a conference and go on one of the tours, certainly get credit for that, for taking a tour. And as I was saying, I think around Compost Awareness Week, we really encourage open house and tours by our composters as a way to help build that awareness and that momentum of that week. It's a great time to have people in and visiting your site, different kind of education, but it's also important, more general public education, not professional development.
Yeah.
That's like mini shadowing. I mean, almost every composter, if you call them up and say, I want to get into this business, I want to come visit, when is a good time to do? There's very few that are going to say, no, you can't do that. There are a few. People out there that are real renegades. They've got the magic sauce. They don't want to see it. But most of us know that making compost is not rocket science. It's really attention to detail. It's hard work. It's paying attention to core principles, understanding, and knowing what to do when things go wrong, because things go wrong.
Mm-hmm. They sure do. And you're in New York now, right?
I'm in upstate New York.
Yes. Upstate New York. Okay.
Proud Trojan, as I live in Troy, New York.
Great. Great. Okay. So when you look back at all your different work with county government, academia, nonprofits, and national industry leadership, how did each of those experiences shape your understanding of what composters need in order to thrive?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because it really depends on what you need to thrive. Kind of depends on, well, first of all, we are talking about the individuals, the people, or the organizations, right? So for people to thrive, we need reliable income and place to live and work that's meaningful. And I think that meaningful work sometimes gets lost, but it really has a message I've tried to give to my children and that I've lived by, that having something that at the end of the day, you can feel good about doing it. And the drudgery of work, that every workplace has its crap that you have to deal with. But what's going to help you thrive as a person is one thing. But I think what you're asking about is as organizations, as composters, either as governments or as some kind of organization, a business. Really, what I taught and thought about is they have different missions to ultimately. And so a thriving for-profit, obviously, it depends on their return on investment, able to make money and continue to do what they're doing. But as a nonprofit or a government, they're really service. Ultimately, what they deal in is a service and providing services to their members or their residents or their ratepayers or whatever they are. And so those will be different paths that they'll take to thrive. Ultimately, they both all need markets and they need really solid markets for their finished product, ways to get. As composters, you know, we're processors, we provide services to our customers as people have to deal with their wastes. And I don't find waste a dirty word. I think waste is just a concept of something that someone needs to pay to get rid of. They have more of it than they need. They need to get rid of it. As composters, we can take a lot of it and we can produce something that benefits the soil and benefits the plants. And so we have, you know, so ultimately a thriving industry depends on that thriving and healthy market.
Great answer. Definitely the end product and market is going to be what drives much of the success there.
I think we love the process. You know, it's like farmers love to grow food, but they don't like to market it so much often.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of composters like that. They really get into the making of the compost, but in the end, it's about making a product that has beneficial uses. That's good for us.
I remember I took a business class. They kept talking about your brand. And I just got this icky feeling. I don't like to even think of this place as a brand. Hmm. And they're like, just reframe it in your mind. This is your story. It's not a bad word. So I've had to think about that. Sure. I don't know where the bad feelings about marketing or branding came from, but maybe it's just our society's illness with it. But I have had to think, okay, no, this is our story. This is our farm story. And this is not a bad thing to.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. This episode is brought to you by AgriLab Technologies. Visit them at agrilabtech.com/podcast. And Compost Systems of Austria at compost-systems.com. And Compost Capital Network brings together composters, haulers, and capital providers. It supports the next generation of composting infrastructure through educational events focused on financing and by facilitating connections. CCN is proudly sponsored by Laurel Mountain, Claire Vest, and Compost Now. CCN is an initiative of Wanu Organics, a consulting firm focused exclusively on composting and organics recycling. To join the network and learn more, please visit compostcapital.com. All right, so we're going to kind of switch gears a little bit and talk about when you were with the U.S. Compost Council helping to develop their professional credential program. What were you seeing in the industry that made you think that we need something more formal here?
So actually, that was the project that I was first given when I was hired, was to develop a certification program. The reason for that was that my executive director, Stu, was looking at our biggest competitor, which was Swana, and they had developed a certification program for landfill operators that was just a gold mine. I mean, they had gone many states to require it, and so they had a machine making money doing certification and doing training, but the training was totally about the certification because the certification was written into law, so there was this big demand. And so he looked at that and said, we could do that too. We could replicate that. The problem was we didn't have an education program to build a certification program on. And so when you look at what a certification does, it's a way of guaranteeing or affirming to some third party that you have the training, the knowledge, and the capacity to do something. And there are high-stakes certifications like doctors and lawyers and things that have to be very rigorous certifications. And there's kind of lower-stakes certifications, there's private certifications, our industry certifications, kind of a mid-stakes thing. There's, you know, we're changing. I can come back to that. But I wanted to say, so in terms of how we got there with certification, when I started, is that was Stu's vision, but there was a long path to get there. So we first started, we had to launch an education program, Composting Kestrel. It had an education program very early on. It had not been active for many years. Although I'll do a shout out to WORC, the Washington Organics Recycling Council, because they had taken it and they had maintained it and expanded it just for their state. And so when I was hired and I said, okay, before we can do certification, we have to do training. And I looked at all the training programs that were available at the time, WORC being one of them. Louisiana had one, Maryland had one, the Better Composting School. There was the Maine School of Composting. And I kind of contacted all of them. I gathered all their materials and we kind of did a big comparison. So, okay, here's what our program should look like. And that's when we launched the Compost Operations Training Course as our flagship operations training. And that was one of the things that we had a great team of advisors and included Craig Coker. And he has said, it's not operator training. It's operations training. It doesn't matter who it is. And that was a key, even though that distinction is sometimes lost, it's an important one. So that program went on. It was really one of my proudest achievements because over the next several years, we trained, personally helped train over 1,000 people.
Awesome.
As composters. And now I know the program has continued and they're definitely approaching the 2,000 mark. Yeah, that's exciting. And that so we then, once we had that training program and way to then say, okay, now we can go back and look at certification. I actually had a bad taste on certification from some earlier work I had done in Pennsylvania where there was a composter certification, but there was a recycling certification and they needed to get credits and people were coming to some classes clearly not interested in with the topic, just needing the credits.
Yeah.
And that really left the bat. Like I was an educator. I'd actually learned how to be an educator. I'd taught for several years and I was not interested in doing something like that. So I had to come around and say, well, what really would be the purpose of a certification at this point? Now that we're doing training, let's go back and look at certification. We got a good size grant from a 11th Hour Project to help launch this program. And I was able to hire what she called my Sherpa, Georgia Patrick, was a very experienced consultant in the certification world. And she helped guide our program and understood kind of the three legs of certification, which are education, experience, and a test. Kind of those three, you kind of demonstrate that you have the experience and the education, you pass a test and then you're certified and then you have to do something to maintain certification. And that's where the education comes in because continuing education is a core part of being certified. You have to maintain current knowledge. And so that helps drive educational opportunities as well.
And like SWANA, are there places, municipalities that require this training for composters?
Almost. It's one of the biggest hurdles that, so as part of having a certification program, you have a certification commission. USCC established that commission. It's a quasi-independent body that is made up of the top people who understand this program and help guide it. And one of the goals is to get, if a state were to require this certification of their operators, of their facilities, to have a certified operator at a facility, then that would be a great thing to happen because it would mean that we're getting more people, that the operations, the premise is that a certified operator runs a better program, runs a better facility. And so the state can be more confident in that facility is going to meet environmental restrictions, run according to permit, the things that they're interested in. And so North Carolina is almost there. I mean, they do require training for a trained operator. Our certification meets the definition of that. So there is benefit of it, but it's not quite as tight as like the MOLO requirement. A few states have their own requirements for certification, but they run their own internal certification system, like a licensing system. So we haven't been able to make our certification. We could do that easily because the way the test was designed is that here's a core test. And if, let's say, Ohio wanted to use our certification as their certification, we would add on a supplemental set of questions for Ohio.
Okay.
So it'd be easy to do. And we're set up to do that.
Good. All right. Well, we can talk more about this, but now that you've stepped back a bit and congratulations on retiring.
Mostly retiring.
I don't think that's ever like a real thing, but you're doing so much. You're knitting and gardening and biking, which I'm super jealous of. What perspective has retirement or semi-retirement given you about where this industry is headed? Now that you've stepped back a little bit.
Yeah, I've been really blessed to kind of be where I am and have the interest I had and then have this position at the Compost Council where I really might help put together the conference every year, still involved in that. Education, but really serve as a broker of putting people together. Like people would call me and say, I have this problem. And I would say, okay, you need to call this person.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to connect people has given me a really good perspective. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, I think I've known either as a friend or a colleague, every person you've interviewed on this podcast
wow.
for 4 years.
Yeah.
I've been around for a long time and seen the growth, and it has been growth, but it's not been straight line growth. Solve some problems, we grow some, and then, oh, now this other set of issues burble up. And so I think whether it was odor issues at one point, and then stormwater became the big regulatory roadblock, and everyone's like, oh my God, we have to, how are we going to manage this? And finally, going, oh, well, we can manage that. And it does cost more, and we'd have to do that. Now we're looking at, you know, this issue around compostables and how do we manage compostables? And you're doing a good job of kind of covering that issue from various sizes, various perspectives.
Not everyone agrees with you on that. Yes.
No, I know, but it's a lot. There's a lot of perspectives out there.
And yeah, I'm trying to honor all of them for sure.
Yeah, it's not easy because that's my job when I was at the council and going to meetings was always to represent the composter's perspective.
Yeah.
And because I've seen a lot of multi-stakeholder groups come and go, task forces, collaboratives, collectives, consortiums with other industries. And often the composter was the least represented. And so my job was to represent the composter in these discussions. And so I think one of the things I really encourage that is we're getting better as the council grows and as we able to collaborate with like-minded organizations. Power to influence policy and to recognize that this is a critical piece of the infrastructure for a sustainable society. My tagline on my emails is, composting may not save the world, but we can't save the world without composting.
I love that. I've used that quote. Thank you for that one.
Yeah. You're welcome. And you know, it comes out of this long journey from the home and recognizing that, yeah, we need the million, how many home composters are there? Who knows? Millions. I mean, it's a big country. There's a lot of home composters out there. When people talk about certifying something for home compostable, I recognize the value of that goal, and I recognize the challenge of what does it mean to be home compostable? Because if you go on Facebook and there's a Facebook group called Composting, Just Composting, and you look at what people do, it's so diverse, and there's so many. So that's such a challenge. You know, we are part of the, you know, plastics writ large are a huge issue. Compostable plastics are part of that solution.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to be. We're not, at least in the near to midterm. I mean, the long-term goal of all reusables is wonderful and valuable, but that's not going to be the case in the near to midterm. We're going to use disposables. And so the extent that those disposables can be compostable and get composted and be part of a healthy compost is part of that. This has to be part of that future. And let me just do it. I don't know if we have how much time we have. Just a quick dive on organics and OMRI, and because that issue drives me nuts. Because organics, OMRI is certifying the USDA standards. It's a consensus-based organization that says, we're organic farmers, and if we're certified organic farm, we don't want these compostables in it. That is their right to say that. I may or may not agree with it, but that's fine. It's a marketing program. Ultimately, being certified organic, I have very good friends who farm organically but are not certified because they don't need the marketing benefits of a certification.
They know their customers. Yeah.
Get everything to local restaurants. They don't need that expense. But I understand there's this role for this marketing program, and it's called the National Organics Program. And if they want to make that rule, they're entitled to make that rule. I don't think that compost, and as you've heard, lots of composters make great quality compost using compostables. So I don't like that connection that has been made that says you can't call something compostable unless it can be accepted in a National Organics Program.
Well, I haven't heard that that's a thing with the wording compostable.
Yeah. That is the thing. That is what California did.
Yeah.
You know, they're, and that's a big market for compostables. And so that's a huge issue. I don't like making that connection. Things are compostable. Things can be compostable and not accepted by the National Organics Program.
Yeah.
And composters can choose to make one, other, or both.
Yeah.
That's their business plan. They can make it work.
Yeah.
So I'll get off that soapbox right now.
I almost want to dive into it more.
Off that, because compostables were a huge part of my work for the last 10 years before I retired. And I've continued on even post that in terms of testing. I've been really involved in developing a testing program that demonstrates, and these things break down. And on, these are the conditions under which they break down. And the composting consortium, you know, funded some of that work. I've worked with BSI Bio and the compost, I can't remember the acronym, but our field testing program at CREF, and they do break down. And the fact that therefore that they're not tied into...
Yes, and just to add that the composting consortium is one of the many initiatives of the Closed Loop Center.
Do you mind if we keep going with this a little bit? So at the compost conference I was just at, there was this dark cloud, and I don't know all the details about it, about this California issue with compostables.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind sharing the source of it? There's a sense that the compostable industry could be crushed, right, by legislation in California. Can you give us a little backdrop of it? Do you feel comfortable with that? I know this is like way off script.
I can try. So California wants to really have legit, you know, robust recycling programs and recycling markets for recyclables. And so compost falls under that, and they want robust markets for compostables. And in California, unlike any other state, there's a huge market for compost by certified organic farms. And the composters recognize that by non-organic farms as well, but there's a it's a big industry in California, and it's a big market for a lot of composters. And so,
and they're big farms. They're not just selling to their local restaurants. They're shipping across the country. And
I just was out there after the conference. I took a drive down through the Central Valley and around and Central Coast. And yeah, farms in California are so different than where the farms we're used to in New York and Pennsylvania and Rhode Island and Massachusetts. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. So that's a big market. And so the legislation was written that to make this connection that said that for something to be labeled compostable and that has to be acceptable to organic farms. And but on the other hand, they have legislation saying municipalities have to collect compostable or they have to divert compostables from landfills. So it's not a collection mandate, but it's a diversion mandate, right? And so the composters are getting squeezed between being required to accept the collections from their green bins that the municipalities want to put into compostables because that ups their diversion rate. And that's true. They are compostable and they should be going to composters. But the composters then end up losing their market, losing a huge market. That's the conundrum. That is the way the laws have been written. And so the compostable product manufacturers are not going to be able to label their products as compostable. And that's a big part. I don't know, 50, 60%. I mean, they have different numbers, but it's a big part of their product, of their market.
Yeah, it seems like just a wording problem. This is just a wording problem.
Well, it's a concept.
Yeah.
It's a concept problem to be. So I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of emails and note from about making that connection. But it is the connection, and it's true. And those are the laws. So figuring out how to legitimize, I know you've heard about EPR, the extended producer responsibility, so the compost, how can they pay into a system that there isn't a market for their products?
Yeah.
It is a real hot issue, and they tried to kick the can down the road for a year.
I'm going to back up a little bit. Composter can choose what goes onto their compost. So what, like?
Not if they have municipal contracts.
Okay. All right. In California.
That's the fear. In California.
Okay.
Me and the Composting Council, we are feedstock. You know, the composter should be able to decide what they take. Yeah. Bottom line. There should not be any issue about that. But if you have a municipal contract, that is not always true. So big facilities need big input streams with good, reliable dollars. So the composters, because of this OMRI thing, we only will accept food, no packaging.
Yep.
We can't take any packaging. And then therefore, because of the labeling law, they won't be able to label their stuff compostable as well. And that's
labeling law is problematic. Yeah.
So the labeling is the intersection between the two.
Huh. Okay. Yeah. There was definitely a feeling like,
Yeah, and I don't have to say, you know, the issue with compostables, so the organic certification, that's one big one, and that I don't like that. But the bigger issue is contamination and the fact that, you know, lookalikes, it's so hard to educate to get clean stream if you're taking something with packaging.
Yep.
And the contamination costs. And that's why I really like about what I've been saying. And because I listened to your podcast and I went and downloaded the Compost Consortium's EPR report.
Great. We will include that EPR report published by the Composting Consortium in the show notes again this episode.
It's really pleasing to see the things I've been saying there.
Yeah.
That you want composters to take this stuff, there's added costs. They need to be compensated, and they need to be compensated with profit.
Yeah.
Not just, if it's just covering their costs, they're not getting ahead of the game. Why would they do it? It's a lot easier to not take it. So if you want them to take these materials, they can do it, but it has to be incentivized. It has to be paid for. I was able to work with them on the disintegration program, but as part of that, I got to see the process of audits and number fact checking and number checking and drilling down and really working to come up with real numbers that are hard to do. And it takes real work. It's not,
it does.
And they do a good job.
That's great. That's great. Okay. So that was really off our script there.
Yeah, that's fine. One of the ways I'm still involved, though, is I'm mostly retired. What I still do is training. I do teaching for CREF. I do teaching for EPA. I've had opportunity to do some tribal training through different regional EPA regions. And then work on compostables issue, especially around kind of the field testing and education. That's, I've stayed involved that way.
You still got your sense of wonder. I love it.
Yes.
Any last parting words you want to share with all the composters out there?
God bless you all. It's really, when you look at what's going on in our world and you see questions about AI and what the hell is AI and wars, and being a composter really helps ground you in so many ways. And it's something that you never have to worry about being replaced by a robot, that this is real work, meaningful work. You can feel good about it at the end of the day. Just thank you.
So beautiful.
I'll end it with that.
Thank you so much, Gary. Great
You're
talking
welcome,
to
Jane.
You.
Take care.
Take care. Gravity rings around Saturn and as we close out this episode, I want to thank Gary Oceans for spending time with us and for the decades he's poured into strengthening this industry. Although he's semi-retired, I bet he'd respond if you email compostercarry@gmail.com. And Carry is spelled C-A-R-Y. Growing the compost profession requires as much intentionality as making good compost does. It takes education, it takes humility, it takes willingness to keep learning, and it takes experienced leaders who are willing to share what they've learned with the next generation. For those of you in your early composting journey, I hope this episode gave you some direction. And for those of you who've been at it for years, maybe it offered a moment to reflect on how far we've come. Carrie, thank you for being part of that growth. Thank you for doing the hard work. Today's show is also generously sponsored by AgriLab Technologies, Compost Systems of Austria, and Compost Capital Network. Thank you from the entire composting community for supporting this podcast. I want to share a huge thank you to the people who make this show possible behind the scenes. Galen and Yasna Brown for all their support, Isadora Biggs for being a wonderful assistant, Pete Hamilton for editing these episodes, and of course, the great music of Soul Shot. If you'd like to show your compost pride, be sure to check out our composter merch at the EarthCare Farm website, earthcarefarm.com. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach me, your host, Jane Murner, at info@earthcarefarm.com or on Instagram at @composterpodcast. I'll be back in 2 weeks to talk about financing your compost operation with Jorge Montezuma and Paula Liu. Thank you so much for listening, you compost lovers.